Welcome to the first episode of Beyond the Filter, a podcast about censorship brought to you by the Center for Online Safety and Liberty. We cover censorship through laws, self-censorship, and corporate censorship. We'll look at censorship of art and fiction, censorship of political dissent, and censorship of self-expression, especially when it comes to sex and gender. We'll also look at the reasons why we censor, the effects of censorship, and alternatives to censorship.
Our mission in this podcast is to explore how censorship has been used in misguided and sometimes malicious ways when tackling safety concerns in our modern, intensely online world. We'll be looking at all sorts of real examples of censorship in our online spaces, from government policies to the self-censoring of online communities, then showing how these attempts to protect people often backfire. In some cases, we'll be questioning whether this censorship was ever really about protecting people, or if there were some other less noble motivations at play. We will acknowledge and examine some of these genuine concerns about online safety, such as the exploitation of minors and the spread of misinformation. We'll ask if there are any scenarios where censorship is an appropriate solution, and take a look at alternative methods of dealing with these concerns, which use science and reason-based approach.
What makes the impulse to censor so difficult to fight is that it literally pervades government, industry, and society. Sometimes it's about money. We'll be talking about censorship through copyright law in a future episode. Sometimes it's about partisan politics. We'll be talking about that too. But most often it seems to be about sex, because the surest driver of censorship is moral panic, and there's no moral panic like a sex panic.
What we dream of seeing is an internet where users are safe from abuse, exploitation, and misinformation, but where they also have the freedom to enjoy and express themselves without getting slammed by misguided laws or puritanical condemnation. We think that evidence-based policy and the smart use of technologies could be the key to seeing this dream realized. But first, we got to push back against the bad policy, bad ideas, and bad faith to make way for the good stuff.
That means being honest with ourselves, and sometimes that's difficult. When you're swimming in a sea of cultural sex negativity, circling a drain of QAnon conspiracy theorists and fascists, waving the freak flag can attract the wrong sort of attention. There's a lot of bigotry that we all have to unlearn. So what are the real problems underlying the moral panic that drives censorship? Is censorship the best way to deal with those problems? If not, what are some of the alternatives? This podcast is a safe space for us and our guests to talk about these issues without censorship and with respect for the full diversity of human fantasy and creativity.
I'm Brandy, and I've been chronically online since I got a dial-up connection back in 2004. I've spent many hours on the internet, mostly participating in social media spaces revolving around fandom and other geeky things. During the 2010s, I started noticing a shift in attitudes in these spaces towards a more puritanical pro-censorship bent, which led to some vicious attacks on users who refused to conform to this new norm. I tried to create a new social media platform where people could enjoy fan activities without this toxicity, but it proved to be a more difficult enterprise than I was prepared for. But that's a story for a future episode.
And I'm Jeremy, a human rights activist, lawyer, and tech industry consultant, who also began my online life in fandom. In fact, I was the editor of one of the first web-based fanzines back in the 1990s. Brandy and I are also both on the board of the Center for Online Safety and Liberty, which hosts this podcast. So it's probably no coincidence that supporting fans is part of its mission, along with safer hosting and combating cyberbullying and abuse, both of which Brandy has already mentioned as concerns for fans. But the final part of the mission of the Center for Online Safety and Liberty, or COSL as I might call it from now on, is legal advocacy. So being the lawyer on the team, I'd like to talk a bit more about that, because a lot of the laws that censor and criminalize content online are framed as safety laws. Now, I'm not saying that safety laws are not sometimes needed. Not all laws restricting internet content are bad or unjustified. For example, laws against image-based abuse, such as revenge porn and child sexual abuse material, are important to have. But these are crimes with real victims. Where the law oversteps is when it treats fictional or fantasy content, which doesn't create any victims, as the same thing as real abuse material. And in some countries, such as Australia and the United Kingdom, they literally do conflate the two. In other words, the same laws are used to punish people over taboo art and fiction as those that are used to punish child sexual abusers. In other countries, notably the United States, the law does technically recognize the difference between real abuse material and fantasy content, but the police and prosecutors will still often treat them as if they were the same. For example, in October 2023, a California man was sentenced to 33 years imprisonment for publishing a website with obscene stories and art. And 2 years earlier, another man received 40 years in prison for the same thing. That's twice as long as Ghislaine Maxwell received for sex trafficking.
Calls for overbearing censorship don't just come from authorities and conservative groups. Some of these calls are coming from inside the house. It's becoming increasingly common for artists and creators to feel pressure from their own fans and communities to sanitize their works. In fact, it's now commonplace for fans to police each other's self-expression to a frankly absurd degree. Don't get me wrong, drama has always been present in fan communities, or fandom as we call it, but fandom, or at least the parts of fandom that focus around the creation of stories and art and other creative content, used to have a reputation for being pretty sexually liberal and transgressive. But more recently, a moralistic movement has arisen within it that demands creators and fans alike censor themselves, ostensibly to protect groups such as minors, survivors, and minorities. However, the vulnerable are usually those who end up getting the most hurt by this movement's actions, which tend to be inconsistent and frankly don't make a whole lot of sense. I've been a member of online fandom since the early to mid-2000s, and I've noticed a shift in behaviors and attitudes towards what is generally considered acceptable in terms of what one enjoys and creates. When I first got online, one of the most popular fandoms was Harry Potter. I think it still is, actually. And that fandom was buck wild. People wrote stories and made art about characters hooking up with their teachers, with their enemies, with their twins. Now, 28 years later, writing about two unrelated characters with a two-year age gap in a wholesome romantic relationship can get you called a pedophile. It can also get you suicide-baited, doxxed, and spammed with gore. People who engage in this behavior with the justification that certain content is harmful and should be excised from the fandom community are called antis. This comes from the term anti-shipper, as they typically find certain fictional relationships objectionable. It gets hard to believe that antis' behavior is driven by a desire to protect vulnerable people from harmful content, when the people being directly harmed by said actions are themselves often vulnerable people, such as queer, mentally ill, and neurodivergent teenagers. So why has such a puritanical movement risen out of what was a community that reveled in its own debauchery? And how can we reduce the toxicity in our communities? And do antis have an alternative motive for their behavior? Do they have a point that taboo content can cause harm? And if there is harm, how can we structure our fandom communities to minimize it?
So these are some of the many topics that we'll be talking about in this podcast in greater depth over the coming months. And we're going to dive in and have more of a freeform discussion about them now. So I wanted to start by posing a question to Brandy. Tell me your thoughts about to what extent are these attempts at censorship real, honest, well-meaning attempts to reduce harm? And then to what extent are they just a pretext for some other agenda?
I do think that there are some kids who genuinely believe that if like someone reads a story about a teenager having sex with their teacher, they'll then go and have sex with their teacher. I'm sure there are people who genuinely believe that and do have the motive of trying to reduce harm. But if you stop and like look at how a lot of these antis behave, what they attack is so selective and hypocritical in terms of what they get outraged about. Like, take the South Park fandom, for example. Yes, there are South Park antis. They are not upset about all these sort of like pedophilia, incest, cannibalism, etc. that happens within the show. They're only upset about it if it happens in fandom and fan art. So like if something less outrageous, but maybe like slightly taboo, like someone writes a fan fiction about, say, like a 16-year-old and an 18-year-old in a relationship that is tantamount to pedophilia to these people, but they don't mind watching a show where an episode has a kindergartner depicts a kindergartner having sex with a teacher, as I understand happens in South Park.
There are so many examples of that. I still can't get over the fact that members of the Hannibal fandom will go off against how immoral the pro-ship fans are when we're literally talking about a show about a cannibalistic serial killer. It really seems like the original creators get held to a different standard of moral purity than the fans. And there's not even a lot of consistency about what sort of content is morally pure. I have to confess I'm reading the first book in the Fire and Ice trilogy, aka Game of Thrones, right now. And we all know that there's incest and what would be classified as child sexual abuse in the source material. But what I found interesting is that they made it even more graphic in the TV adaptation. There's one scene in the TV version of Game of Thrones that depicts a violent sexual assault, which is depicted as consensual in the original source material. So I guess we see it as more morally acceptable to depict violence and even sexual violence than it is to show non-violent sexual content sometimes. So that's an example from Hollywood, but in fandom, it's even more true, right? You know, where people practicing literal cannibalism, no problem. But, you know, having a relationship between, you know, a 17-year-old and a 19-year-old, my God, you're a pedophile.
Yeah, it's interesting as well that a lot of aunties tend, just from what I've seen, it does seem like a lot of aunties are big fans of gore and they enjoy sort of romantic content that romanticizes violence and like eviscerations and cannibalism. If one of the characters is underage, then suddenly it's just gone too far.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. And I think it's a reflection of our society as well, isn't it? Because we're seeing the same sort of overreaction to sexual diversity in the real world as well. Like members of the LGBTQ community being stigmatized as groomers, especially people like drag queens being stigmatized in that way, when heterosexual couples can be far more overtly sexual with nobody batting an eye and nobody talking about grooming. So there's this kind of exceptionalism that our society has where anything sexual, especially queer sexual, is seen as being inherently dangerous or predatory or, you know, kind of dirty. And so I think that's what's happening with censorship of media reflecting a deeper social dysfunction around sex. I think it's a deeper issue that we need to look at. Like, is sex negativity really helping to save people from predation, or is it actually in some ways worsening it and pushing people into dark spaces where perhaps people are more likely to be victimized?
I remember a Tumblr post that called like this kind of attitude among like fandom spaces puritanism with a rainbow hat, because although like aunties are very like on the surface very accepting of like a LGBTQ people and tend to be queer themselves, they do not have a positive attitude towards sex. So they're kind of echoing a lot of conservative values and attitudes, but just putting a rainbow flag on top of them.
Yeah, that sort of punching down within the queer community is troublesome, because once you start gatekeeping and telling people that certain fetishes are off limits, certain types of sexual expression or gender expression are problematic, then these marginalized groups tend to turn on themselves. And like a lot of infighting within fandom and within queer communities, it isn't coming from right-wingers, you know, it's coming from left-wingers. It's from progressive people who are trying to police each other, you know, in this frantic attempt to reach this desired standard of moral purity.
I swear there are people who spend more time eating their own than they ever do directing any sort of energy towards conservative and bigoted groups that actually threaten the queer community. It's just shocking what I've seen in that sense.
I think a lot of it is because we don't have a very principled understanding of sexual ethics. A lot of it just comes from our monkey brains. You know, if something triggers us as disgusting, then therefore it's morally wrong. But that's something I think we need to unlearn, right? I mean, we need to replace that with a more principled form of sexual ethics, which actually divides right from wrong in a more sensible way. And in fandom, that of course is the divide between fiction and reality. In the kink and BDSM communities, likewise, there's a saying that your kink is not my kink, and that's okay. And in queer communities in general, it's about consent culture, right? So I think a lot of that learning needs to escape into the mainstream a bit more. Particularly young fans and young queer people maybe don't have that background as part of their sex education or media literacy education, and that's why they can lash out so hard against things that trigger a personal ick for them. And then when that attitude or that reaction gets normalized within broader popular culture, well, that's what fuels the rise of harmful anti-LGBTQ movements, as we see in Donald Trump's second term and his Project 2025, which I know we'll be talking about in future. It's fueled an even greater swing against particularly queer content existing online.
Queer people existing in general?
Queer people existing in general. And it's a really noticeable shift, I think. I mean, it wasn't long ago that particularly big tech platforms were considered to be, you know, very inclusive. They were in the pride parades. They were, you know, enforcing rules against hate speech pretty aggressively. And now all of that seems to have changed. You know, Facebook and X are now openly allowing hate against transgender people.
Yeah, They removed the transgender theme from the Meta Messenger, in case you didn't know about that.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. Yeah, we're seeing so much of that. And it's, of course, really just an echo of what the United States in particular is doing to roll back LGBTQ rights in general. And debates over shipping and kinks in our communities are a tiny microcosm of that. So I feel like now is a very important time to be addressing this from a human rights perspective and from a perspective that looks at censorship, alternatives to censorship, and safe spaces that are free of censorship. Because you can't fully have safety online without having freedom online. Like, bullying and hate speech aren't compatible with a free internet. They create a chilled internet where some people are afraid to be themselves, to present themselves online, to speak authentically. And so to have safety for those communities, for marginalized communities, is necessary if we really want to have a free and open internet. I know, Brandy, your fandom project, the one that you were alluding to, and I don't know if you want to go into details now, but that was one of the things you were trying to do, wasn't it? To ensure that there was this space that was not only free in terms of censorship, but also free of bullying, free of hate.
That was the idea. And I would hopefully like to see a site like that come into existence in some form, even if I couldn't realize it at the time, because just having the ability to enjoy the things I and other people enjoy without having to be told that I should be raped and murdered and that I'm like the worst person alive would be lovely.
Yeah, a lot of it also has to do with immaturity. And we have to have spaces where it's okay to have different opinions. It's okay to have different likes and dislikes, but where there is this kind of base level of literacy about how to deal with those differences. And it's not by lashing out. It's not by making people feel bad about themselves. It's about learning how to process your uncomfortable feelings, utilizing safety tools to curate your own safe experience.
That's why at the time I was hoping to create a space that also educated its users by providing resources and also like almost education on critical thinking to encourage that kind of environment and that kind of mindset.
And now, with a bit of learning under both our belts, we're trying to do that again through the Center for Online Safety and Liberty, which is structured as an umbrella organization that can house multiple independent projects that promote the ideals of safety and liberty online. So a media literacy project would fit right into that.
I could go so deep into this because this is going beyond like what this podcast is about, just into sort of the fundamentals of morality and people's capacity to think, because I just think it's a lack of critical thinking skills when you get right down to it. And it's sort of, I'm very biased in the sense that I did my degree in philosophy, and I think everyone should do classes in philosophy personally, because one of the first philosophy classes I ever did was a class on critical thinking, and it actually allows you to understand or like question why you think and feel certain ways and to approach issues from a more rational perspective. And it's, I feel like just the world in general would be such a brighter place if everyone was taught these skills, because I think when we get down to it, well, there's lots of reasons behind why we're seeing what we're seeing, but I think one of the reasons is that people don't understand the fundamental reasoning behind certain like laws and rules and the whatnot. They only understand the value of sort of the rule itself. So, for example, a certain rule might be put in place to protect a certain group of vulnerable people or just protect people in general. And it's like, this rule is necessary in certain contexts and certain situations to help reduce that harm. But people just forget that the point of the rule is to protect people, and then they start caring more about the rule itself than the protection. And then they'll start looking at situations where the rule doesn't really apply and doesn't really help anyone. Then they'll just force the application of that rule in these situations where it actually harms people. But they don't care about the harm. They just care about the rule, or the guideline, or the principle.
Well, that brings us back around to laws that overstep the mark. And COSAL will be doing a lot of activism around those laws. One of the first we've started with is age verification laws that block certain websites, often but not always adult websites, unless you give your identification. So Pornhub, of course, is the biggest magnet for these laws. And Pornhub has taken the decision to just shut down in the states where age verification is required. It's blocking users from those states rather than comply with the verification laws that would put its users' safety and privacy at risk. Because one of the big problems with the verification laws is that once you have a database of people's IDs, especially the IDs of people who are trying to access adult content, that's super, super dangerous, particularly in this new era of authoritarian conservatism. Having a list like that, which could be misused by the government, not to mention by hackers or other corporate interests, is just a very dangerous thing. So age verification laws are one of those simplistic solutions. And I know in Australia, and maybe you can say more about this, Brandy, there's a new law that goes even further than that and basically bans under 16-year-olds from most major social media websites. Is that right?
Yes, that came into effect, I think, a few months ago. And as I understand it, it's one of those things where there was such a big push for something to be done about sort of minors online having, I believe, mental health issues. And that's an issue that definitely exists and definitely needs to be addressed. But just banning them like this is, it's not really, I don't think it's going to be an effective approach, and it's just going to hurt people that it didn't intend to impact. So while it's a real, again, this is what we're trying to talk about. We're trying to talk about real issues, but the imperfect ways that governments and the like are trying to fix them and then offer up alternative, better solutions.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea that it's certainly true that some people do encounter, you know, stress and bullying online and so on, as we've spoken about, just as they do on in the schoolyard. But also by the same token, many of these young people or many other young people find community online that they can't find in the schoolyard. And it's especially young people who may have trouble socializing in the real world, who may be neurodivergent, for example, or queer. And it's often easier for them to find a community of like-minded peers online than it is in the real world. And so while you may be trying to combat one problem by limiting their access to the internet, you're sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater and leaving other people without the support and enrichment that they could have had.
I could go into a rant about politics in general here, because it's a case of like political parties offering up solutions that sound appealing to a large portion of the populace, because I think that most people don't want to think about all the subtle nuances of an issue. They just want a hammer. That everything's a nail, and they want to have a big, hard, simple to understand solution to address an issue they're worried about. They don't want to hear about all these little subtleties of the issues and all the little subtle ways we can fix it. They just want a simple solution that sounds good on paper, and the hollies want to offer it to them because, of course, that's how they get reelected.
And age verification is just one of those. Another example of a simplistic law that's being framed as protecting users but isn't is a bipartisan movement to make internet platforms responsible for the speech of their users. Currently, there's a US law called CDA 230 or Section 230, which basically protects internet platforms from that sort of liability. They're not made directly responsible for what their users upload. So that means if you post, I don't know, a cartoon of Elon Musk with his head up his ass, Elon can't threaten to sue Facebook over that if they refuse to take it down. So it's an important law that has enabled a lot of freedom of expression online, because without it, platforms would be afraid to allow their users to post freely. But now that law's up for grabs. Politicians have decided that Section 230 has got to go.
This is actually one of the things mentioned in Project 2025, along with many other attacks on free speech, which we're going to go into detail in a future episode, where I may or may not have a meltdown over it. So look forward to that. That could be an interesting episode, depending on how well I manage to keep my emotions in check.
Definitely. Project 2025 and the Trump administration have put this whole censorship movement on roller skates, but we'll be going back in history a bit as well and demonstrating how this has been going on for a while. And we've seen the internet progressively becoming less free for some time. A lot of listeners may remember Foster Sester. They may remember when Tumblr came down and banned a whole lot of sexual content that it allowed before.
The infamous case of the female presenting nipples.
Exactly. And other platforms are facing the same concerns and reacting accordingly. We had a very brief period where even OnlyFans decided they weren't going to allow sexual content, which was kind of the raison d'etre for OnlyFans, as far as most people were aware. So they did backtrack on that pretty quickly.
That was a scary couple of hours.
And, you know, we'll be digging into where these pressures are coming from, because it's not always coming from laws. It's not just coming directly from governments. We're seeing payment processors exercising a lot of power over what happens online, stepping beyond their role of accepting payments into becoming more like censors in their own right. And there are other points of what I call free speech weak links, where any step along the road from a speaker to a reader or listener could be a place where censorship happens. So it could be the internet provider, could be the payment processor, could be the advertising intermediary, could be the search engine where the content is discovered. There's so many potential places where censorship can be introduced, and we have battles to fight at every point.
You and I both went through a minefield when trying to get our project started up, trying to find a payment provider that would allow what we want, trying to find a host that would allow what we want. It was a nightmare.
And we will tell that story, I promise you. It does have a happy ending, because the Center for Online Safety and Liberty came out of that struggle.
I'd also like to explore issues of censorship as they've occurred throughout history and also around the world, because I know that I at least felt like progress was inevitable and we're in these cozy, progressive, enlightened, free speech supporting countries where surely everything will just get increasingly rational and increasingly free. But my eyes have really been opened lately. And I think by looking at examples throughout history of censorship and in more authoritarian countries from around the world, we can see how the laws there parallel what's happening in our countries at the moment and show that we're not really so safe and secure in our progressive, high-minded countries, and we could really go back to being like we were in the past or like these more authoritarian countries that exist now. So yeah, I want to explore and draw those parallels.
Yes, because I was talking about Tumblr as history, but you really can look back, can't you, to, you know, Oscar Wilde, you can look to the Marquis de Sade. I've been reading some censored fiction from the 1800s, and I'm like, my God, you couldn't publish that today either.
Yeah, but like, when people say they want to ban certain things, certain types of content, my go-to response is like, you know that if you're going to ban that, you'd also have to ban the Bible, right? Because that's in the Bible.
And you mentioned that you'll be looking into the history of censorship in authoritarian countries. So what are some of the countries you'll be looking at?
For example, I have a few friends from Iran, and I don't know if you or the people listening are familiar with the Iranian Revolution, I believe the 1970s. But while Iran was, I don't think it was ever a democracy as we have, it was definitely a more progressive nation comparatively. I mean, it definitely isn't on the level we have now, but it had more freedom, let's just say. But after the revolution of the 1970s, basically an Islamic theocracy took over and heavily restricted freedoms and speech. And I think seeing how that happened to a country like Iran could give us a greater understanding of how something like that could happen here. Or, for example, Russia during the 1990s, after the Soviet Union fell, a lot of people thought that Russia was going to be headed into it was going to become, I guess, increasingly westernized, you might say, with more free speech, more freedom, more progressive, so on and so forth. And I know when I was a teenager in the early 2000s, I mostly associated Russia with cosmonauts and lesbians, because the big export coming out of Russia was a tattoo and all the things she said. So I thought, yeah, Russia, that seems like a nice progressive place, right? And now look at it. It would seem to be having that trajectory. And now look at how it's going now. It's definitely not what you would call a bastion of free speech, free sexual expression.
Funny you should say that, because in my most recent blog post on my personal website, which I'll put a link to in the podcast notes, I refer to the case of Yulia Tsvetkov, who was a 26-year-old Russian theatre director and artist who was arrested for sharing feminist and LGBTQ-friendly artwork online. And the authorities considered that to be propaganda, promoting non-traditional sexual relations among minors. And the reason why they throw minors in there, it has nothing to do with minors, but the moral panic around sex and minors is they're just milking it. You know, the idea that talking about queer relationships and sexualities is corrupting minors goes well back to the 70s when the USA had this sort of panic going on with homosexuality. It was the idea that gays were recruiting minors to become the next generation of their community. And we still see that in America today, where censorship of sex education, school libraries, books like Gender Queer, which is a queer memoir of a queer person growing up and basically going through their teenage years. Again, we're hearing the idea that this is a kind of propaganda. It's not just a memoir. It's not just a sex education manual. It's an indoctrination tool. You know, you're not reading about someone's life. You're being groomed into gender ideology, which really just means talking about gender and experiences of gender. And so we hear this term grooming, which is very intentionally the same term that they use for grooming someone for sexual exploitation. Simply talking about sexuality in an authentic or personal way is treated as that kind of indoctrination. So I definitely see a lot of parallels between Russia and the United States. And I agree that we may see the US or Australia or the United Kingdom differently than authoritarian countries, but maybe they're not so different. I mean, in the UK right now, as we're recording this episode, they're having a hearing where the government's trying to force Apple to put a back door in its encryption so that if you store documents in your Apple account online and you choose for it to be encrypted, the government would have to be able to access it. And Apple has refused to comply with that so far, and instead they've withdrawn the ability for UK users to access fully encrypted online backups. And there's a hearing going on as to, is the government really entitled to demand this? Europe, as I mentioned too, is also in the same category where we may think of it as being very human rights respecting, and yet there are proposals there for oppressive surveillance laws that could require internet platforms to snoop on content that you share or store online. There's a law being passed around called Chat Control 2.0 that would require everything you put online to be scanned. The UK already has a similar law called the Online Safety Act, and so does Australia. So we may be facing a future in which if you upload some fan art, the law will require it to be scanned for official approval by some AI robot. And if you fail, your fan art could be reported to the police. So yeah, I definitely don't think there is that black and white line between the authoritarian countries and the progressive liberal democracies.
I think it's interesting how you brought up children as the justification, because another thing we should explore is how the people that put these bans and the like in place often use a certain justification, like the idea that they're protecting people and the like, to justify what they're doing. And sometimes they may genuinely think that that's the reason, but I think very often that's just an excuse. The real reason is to maintain power, often to make money, and they're just using children as an excuse because, of course, if you want to pull on someone's heartstrings, you just got to bring up kids. And it's, won't someone please think of the children, unless the children are getting shot, apparently. That's fine.
Or getting married, which is legal in many US states.
Just so long as it's not a gay marriage.
But there's a lot more we can do to really protect children, which involves not trying to have less information online or less access, but just trying to have more good information online. And that can be, you know, education, support. We do need to have safety, but there are different ways of doing that. And I think your website project, you thought very deeply about what sort of safety tools can we have that can stop people from being exposed to material they don't want, which is an alternative to censorship. It's more of a choice to control what you do or don't see, right?
Yeah. And I'm really excited about the possibilities that new technologies bring us to address and solve these issues. I'm looking forward to doing some episodes where we explore all the new technologies on the market and see how they can be applied to basically have our cake and eat it too, because I think the possibilities are endless.
Yeah. One of the things that COSOL is trying to do is to provide some technologies and services that not only we, but anyone can use to help craft an environment that is safe, but not stifling. So just as an example of the kind of technologies we're talking about, content warnings, filters. In fact, this podcast series is called Beyond the Filter, right? So filtering is one way of really curating your own online experience. say that you're triggered about something or something's not age appropriate for you, you don't have to erase it from the internet altogether. You don't have to stop people who want to view it from viewing it. All you have to do is to make sure that your experience is appropriate for you. And so these sorts of tools can be an alternative to the government deciding what you should or shouldn't see. It's empowering users more than trying to smother them.
Yeah, I'm a little bit of a tech head, so new technologies get me excited, and combining them with this topic of censorship and freedom, I might really get going there.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the biggest challenges that online spaces have is how to moderate at scale. And with artificial intelligence, it has a lot of fans, it has a lot of detractors. And that's something we'll be talking about in future episodes as well. Like, what is the potential for AI to help us build the internet we want? And on the other hand, what are the dangers? Certainly in creative spaces, a lot of people are worried about generative AI, sort of detracting from human creativity rather than enhancing it. And so we'll be talking about both sides of that coin in future episodes.
It's a very deep and complicated issue that will be a lot of fun to pull apart.
Absolutely. So we'll be talking to each other about this stuff. We'll be talking to other people, and we'll be highlighting some community projects that COSOL is sponsoring. These include advocacy projects, art projects, open source software projects, podcasts like this one. So there are many things that we can do under this banner, all acting towards the same mission to promote safety and liberty online. And so this is our attempt to give back to the community at the same time as resourcing the community to join with us in fighting for the things that are important to us and that are important to the people we care about. Yeah. So one of the initial projects of COSOL is a hosting provider called Liberato, which is designed so that you don't have to worry too much about your content being taken down. Obviously, we need a baseline level of safety, which is ensuring that nothing illegal can be put up online. But beyond that, we don't want to be telling people too much about what sort of art they can create, what sort of stories they can write. If you're a model and you're posting photos, do you have to remove stuffed animals from your room because it looks too childlike? Do you have to worry about the ages of the fictional characters in the stories you post? Do you have to worry about, you know, whether this fictional alien or talking animal is going to be interpreted as bestiality? No, our aim with Liberato is really meant to take away a lot of the subjective considerations that other platforms have been laying down and just keeping things simple. Basically, if what you're putting online is legal and consensual, then you should have no problems hosting it on Liberato.
And maybe some listeners are wondering, but why do you want to post that kind of stuff? Why do you want to enjoy that kind of stuff? And that's something we'll be exploring in this podcast as well, sort of the psychology behind what draws people to this kind of taboo content. And why having these kinds of interests and fantasies does not reflect on what someone will want in reality. And also the science behind what happens when people indulge in these sorts of fantasies in a purely fantastical space, and whether or not that compels them to then make the transition from fantasy to reality. We'll also be looking at what the science actually says about the impact of taboo art, and look into the motivations people have for making this art in the first place.
Because it's not just one thing. It's not just one reason, is it?
There's going to be a whole episode on that, but I enjoy some interesting stuff and I have my own pretty complicated reasons for it. And I know other people who like the same stuff who have completely different real motivations behind it.
As I kind of teased earlier, we're also going to be talking about how we can try and use this science and new technology to try and solve some of these problems without sacrificing safety or freedom or creativity. We'll be talking about some Free Speech Week links and some of the recommended approaches to overcoming them. We'll be talking about some of our own projects, some other people's projects, and we'll be having some guests from time to time.
So as you can see, we've got a lot to cover and we're excited to explore all these issues with you. Starting with our next episode, which will center around the Trump administration and Project 2025. Let's just say it's some scary shit.
So with that, I think we'll wrap up our pilot episode. Feel free to leave your feedback because we'd love to hear from you. If there's anything you'd like us to cover in future episodes, let us know. Please share the link to this podcast on your favorite listening app, and we'll be back to discuss this some more. So thanks very much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. So now it's goodbye from me, Jeremy.
And goodbye from me, Brandy.